So, according to my records, which are anything but pristine, according to my records, the last time I actually preached from this passage was in June of 2006. For some of you, the messages from Ecclesiastes may seem like they were not that long ago, and hopefully that's the case in a good way. Hopefully that wasn't vanity and striving after wind going through that process. It did take me 61 messages to get through Ecclesiastes the first time that I went through it. But the passage that we're going to look at tonight, at least as far as I'm concerned, from my perspective, is probably the key to the whole book. It is the one paragraph, the one takeaway, the one application that if we actually grasped, we would be much better off. For curiosity's sake, how many of you who are here tonight have actually heard the Enjoying the Process message? All right. So, every once in a while, somebody who heard that message is originally two parts that I gave in the youth ministry and then two parts that I did again a few months later in big church. That two-part message on enjoying the process actually became sort of an acronym and actually became a little way we would quiz one another. Are you ETPing? And every once in a while, somebody brings out that phrase again. You just need to ETP. You just need to enjoy the process. And I'm glad that it caught on. Didn't quite make it to WWJD status, but those only come along once in a lifetime, probably. Nobody made any wordless bracelets out of ETP. Those marketing opportunities are still out there for those who are so inclined. But nevertheless, enjoying the process, that particular phrase, it's not copyrighted because it's a fine phrase in and of itself. But that at least is my summary of Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 24 to 26. And hopefully you'll see why that's an important phrase, enjoying the process, or ETP, as we study through it. The wisest man who ever lived, apart from the God-man, Jesus Christ, the wisest not God and man who ever lived on the planet, once said, "Life is hard, and then you die." All right, well, actually, he didn't say that word for word. Life is hard, and then you die. But his life motto in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 2, is very close. We're going to get a running start into the last paragraph in chapter 2. Starting in chapter 1, verse 2, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Vanity is not the word for what the guys can now do in the upstairs bathroom with our fancy mirror, protecting us from preaching with snot in our beard in the future. Perhaps that's happened where the first five or six rows noticed that a couple months ago. Now there's a fix for that. It's not that kind of vanity. It's not a bathroom vanity. It's not pride vanity. It's a meaninglessness. Some translations even use that as the word in chapter 1, verse 2. Meaninglessness, meaninglessness, all is meaningless. Or breath, or vapor, useless, no good, vanity. From the opening chapter of Ecclesiastes, Solomon the preacher laments the emptiness and difficulties of life under the sun. In his introductory poem, he talks about the fact that nothing has meaning, nothing is ever finished, nothing is under our control, nobody cares, nobody is ever satisfied, and nothing is original, no one will remember us, and then we die. That is actually a longer way to say life is hard, and then you die. In chapter 1, verse 12, he begins his search for life under the sun. And he starts by looking for meaning and satisfaction behind the door of wisdom. Verses 12 through 18 in chapter 1. But when he opens that door, he found that with more wisdom comes pain and sorrow. Look at chapter 1, verse 18. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Apparently, wisdom and education are not the keys to a meaningful life. And then as he continues his search for meaning, his pursuit of life under the sun, in chapter 2, he turns from getting wisdom to getting pleasure, and he spared no expense to try to do that. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Verse 3, he tests the buzz of alcohol or drugs under the umbrella of pleasure pursuing. In verses 4 through 6, he looks for meaning in his accomplishments and great projects. And there was never a greater king in Israel, at least, who accomplished the projects that he did. Verse 7 through the beginning of verse 8, he searches for satisfaction in stuff, what he was collecting. The middle of verse 8, he explored the pleasures of entertainment and diversions. Finally, at the end of verse 8, he pursued the pleasures of women and sex, a man with 1,000 women in his palace between wives and concubines. He surpassed everyone before him in Jerusalem in each of these pursuits. Whatever he wanted, he got. He devoted his life to finding the right toy or the finest possessions, all while claiming at least that his wisdom remained with him. Perhaps no other individual in history was arrayed in such glory, which is why Jesus uses Solomon as the example. Not even Solomon was arrayed like the lilies of the field, but he chooses Solomon because Solomon was well arrayed. And after all of that, look at chapter 2, verse 11. Solomon's conclusion is, then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. But it actually does get worse. In the next paragraph, verses 12 through 17, he realized not only that his own pursuits were empty, but that he wasn't going to take any of it with him when he died. He complains in verse 17, the end of that paragraph, so I hated life for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me because everything is futility and striving after wind. And it gets worse. He adds to that cheery thought that once he was gone, there was no guarantee that his successor would deserve all of the stuff Solomon had got. The one who came after him may actually be an idiot who hadn't done any work to enjoy all that Solomon had gained in his toil. So verses 22 and 23 summarize that. For what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous, even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity. It is a sad message that life is miserable, meaningless, and monotonous. It is empty, and yet it exhausts you, and you do it every day, over and over again. All of life is an unhappy business. That's his description in chapter 1, verse 13. Life is hard, and then we die. That is horrifically depressing. But, that's the good transition word. There is something different about this paragraph at the end of chapter 2. In fact, there is a word used in this paragraph that has not yet been used in the book of Ecclesiastes. It is one little word that buoys us up back to the surface, gets our head out of the waves at least for a moment, and allows us to catch a breath and fill our lungs with air. It is the word joy. What has not yet been found until this paragraph is joy. Verse 26, to the one who pleases him, God has given joy. For the first time now, we see the possibility of real enjoyment. And it is no coincidence that there is another major difference between this paragraph and the preceding paragraphs in Ecclesiastes, namely that for the first time, in a positive way at least, God is mentioned. Joy is first here. God is first here. God was mentioned in chapter 1, verse 13, not as the answer to mankind's problems, but as the organizer of mankind's problems, so not necessarily positive. Everything else has been dominated not by joy, not by God, but by phrases like under the sun, by words like vanity and striving after wind. In this paragraph, however, the sovereign, joy-giving God fills the landscape. It is one of the few explicit positive notes in the book. There are not many high points in Ecclesiastes, not many encouragements or enticements to joy. Most of it is bad news, depressing news. But this is positive. This is encouraging. Here is where we can find joy. It is one of the things that 8 years later from preaching those messages, I am still trying to learn and apply. I have dismality down. I know how to do dismality. It's not really a word, but it's the combination of a couple of things that just sound bad. I know full well how to see life as hard and inconvenient, and all of us, to one degree or another, need to learn the not-so-secret to life, how to enjoy the process as a gift of God. There's three main points that we're going to consider tonight, starting with the first part of verse 24, the superlative prospect of joy in toil. The superlative prospect of joy in toil. A comparative is when you make a comparison between things and one thing is good, the other thing is better. A comparative, good and better. But a superlative is of the highest quality or degree. We could say, ungrammatically, there isn't anything bester. A superlative is the bestedness, the highest of highs. Nothing can be found that is better than what is best, the superlative. Look at the first part of verse 24. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This is not an unqualified statement, as if being with God in heaven isn't actually better. Solomon is describing life under the sun, describing life on the planet. He's not describing the afterlife. He's not describing heaven. He's not describing the forever eternity that we'll be face-to-face worshiping God. That is better. Being away from the presence of sin is better. But when it comes to our day-to-day lives on earth, there is nothing better. That's the superlative prospect. Nothing better. So this is it. Right here is the answer. Here is life. Here is how to have meaning in life, or at least where meaning in life comes from. Here is the source of satisfaction. Here is the place to find joy. The wisest man who ever lived draws a map for us. There is nothing better under the sun than what Solomon is about ready to describe. And note who this map is for. It's for a person. You know a person. You know a guy. It's for a person. There is nothing better for a person or for a man, which would be the generic understanding of man, which means that this is a general statement, universally applicable, so not just for kings and nobles. This is not just Solomon's experience. He is not limiting the application of this enjoyment just to royalty. The prospect of joy is also then not limited by personality type or when your natural bodily alarm clock likes to wake you up. You don't need to be a morning person or a non-morning person, or be a non-morning person not married to a morning person. Those are not the qualifications for the offer that he's making, the superlative prospect. The possibility of joy here is, we're going to find, not regulated by the type of job one has, and not even necessarily by joblessness. That is, by not having a particular occupation. The principle isn't applicable only for wealthy landowners, nor is it directed at the poor who just don't have enough to be concerned about. The prospect that we're talking about is for a person, regardless of age, regardless of gender, regardless of nationality, regardless of generation, which means that it applies to us. It applies to all of us. So what is this superlative prospect? The New American Standard translates verse 24 like this: there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. I don't like that. Tell himself that his labor is good. The main verb is actually the word see. The ESV translates it as find. Again, back to the verse, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. The NAS saying tell himself that his labor is good can kind of make it sound like we just need to have the talk with ourselves and convince ourselves of something that may or may not be true. But the command is to see it, to find it, to look for it, which means that it's there. We need the eyes to see it. We need the effort to look at it, not just convince ourselves of something that isn't true. Nothing is better, the superlative prospect, nothing is better than finding contentment and joy where we're at right now in what we're doing. Truly is not going to sell a lot of books. It hasn't, actually. So, and that's all right. Nothing is better than enjoying things like eating and drinking and working. There is nothing better for a person than eating and drinking and finding enjoyment in his toil. These are the everyday mundane things: eating, drinking, working. As I was originally marinating on this passage, there were a number of things that stood out to me about this statement. Probably most of all, what Solomon doesn't say as much as what he does say. It strikes me that as he's talking about enjoyment and joy as a gift of God, there are a number of things he doesn't include for how to have that joy. So consider, for example, a few principles that I think we can draw that aren't in the passage, that are the opposites of what Solomon is saying, starting with, first of all, joy doesn't depend on getting out of toil. We're finding enjoyment in toil, not finding enjoyment in getting out of toil. There isn't anything special about the food, the drink, or the work. It isn't the food, it's the process. It isn't what we're eating and drinking. It's simply that we are eating and drinking. And then there is this toil, this constant cycle. You eat and drink so that you have energy to go work, and you work so that you can have enough money to buy food to eat and drink. And you eat some more because you know tomorrow is going to be a hard day at work where you're making money so you can buy food to eat again so that you can work again. There's nothing special about the food, nothing special about the work. Joy comes in the processes of life, not in stepping out of the normal processes of life. The lesson is enjoy the process. Eating, drinking, working. Enjoy the process. The normal day-to-day rhythms and responsibilities of life. It is interesting, if you were to, throughout the next week, go home and read the rest of Ecclesiastes, you will find that he does not ever once connect joy with getting out of work. But the few times he does talk about joy, he almost always attaches and connects it with toil, with labor, with work. Joy comes in toil, not in getting out of toil. Joy comes in work, not the weekend. According to the verse. Out of all the people who have had access to a workforce of slaves, it would have been Solomon. He didn't have to do anything for himself. He had no limits on his luxuries or pleasure, yet he never explicitly says that having pleasurable things or entertainment brought him joy. He connects finding joy to toil and work and eating and drinking. It isn't in summer break that we have joy. It isn't on vacation that we have joy. It isn't in retirement that we have joy. Not to say that summer break cannot be a reason to praise God. Praise God. Summer break. Amen. Vacations. I don't remember the last one I went on. I am sure it was very good. And amen. I am not doing my version of don't collect seashells and waste your life in saying that joy doesn't come in retirement. What I am saying is, according to this verse, as Solomon explains it, joy is found in the process, not escaping from it. Smack in the middle of work. So joy doesn't depend on getting out of toil. Secondly, a second principle is that joy doesn't depend on the type of toil. There are no qualifications on the type of work in which you can find enjoyment. This would have been a good place to maybe a footnote. By the way, what I meant to include here is that all of those jobs on dirty jobs that you see, not finding enjoyment in your toil there. Which, ironically, a lot of those people do. And Mike Rowe observes that. He's not Solomon, nevertheless. Solomon does not restrict the prospect of joy to certain occupations. He simply says there is nothing better than to find enjoyment in what we do. A person is to see the good and find enjoyment in his toil, with the implication that whatever the toil may be, there is the prospect of joy. Which does amaze me, because I've had some jobs that I variously hated, despised, disdained, held contempt for. Didn't like them. I have had a lot of jobs, and a lot of jobs I did not like. Yet Solomon says there is nothing better than finding enjoyment in whatever we're working at. In other words, the job wasn't actually my problem. I was the problem. Which, that starts stepping on people's toes, so I should probably move on. Now, briefly, I've got a short list of some of the different kinds of jobs that I imagine people in Solomon's time might have had who would have been the first people to read or listen to Solomon's letter, his message, Ecclesiastes. The original audience, the original readers who would have read this, what kinds of jobs might they have had? So as we travel back some 3,000 years to around 931 BC, what kind of people did Solomon expect to apply this truth? And I think we will probably find, as we go back there, that we're going to find our complaints don't amount to jack squat. That we would much rather have our jobs than any of these. Or most of them, or some of them. How about shepherds? Who were usually away from their home with stinky animals. Maybe away for months. Away from the warmth of the home and their family and home-cooked meals. Fighting off dangerous predators. For a shepherd to listen to one of us complain about needing to take work home. Probably not a lot of sympathy there. That we had to work a 60-hour week. Ah, yeah. I was sleeping with my job. You know, not even in a tent, in my cloak. How about farmers or vineyard workers? Consider the lack of conveniences for farmers in Solomon's day. They had no cool farm tractors, and I mean that in both senses. That was always my favorite thing at the fair, was to sit on the tractors. I love that. Nowadays, the tractors that have the air conditioning and the satellite radio, that Solomon's farmer didn't have that. No gas-powered engines. To plow a field, they would strap a sheet of metal on an ox and then hold on. Which might have been fine until the first big rock. Obviously, no control over the weather. Frost, hailstorm, drought could come at any time and destroy the crop. How about construction workers? It took Solomon 13 years to have one of his houses built. Now, we're pushing that on our remodel. But we haven't hired out a lot of the labor. Different for Solomon. 13 years. His palace, the temple. Solomon built cities around Israel. And I anticipate he was probably an exacting boss with high expectations. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people were working on his projects and needing to work hard and work well. How about servants at the palace? Based on what is described in terms of how much food was prepared on a daily basis, or the fact that, for example, there were 12 guys in Israel who had responsibility to grow and organize and herd enough food to take care of 1 month of palace food. 12 guys got administrative responsibilities for 1 month a year. Meaning they were organizing 11 other months a year of gathering and making and creating all the stuff for growing the animals and the crops just to do a month's worth at the palace. There were hundreds, no doubt, of workers at the palace serving all kinds of people, not just Solomon and his family. Talk about dishwashing and getting tired of that. The preparations, as soon as you're done, you're starting over again from scratch for everything. Soldiers. Obviously, not only was being a soldier a life-threatening danger on a daily basis, but the Israeli army spent months, if not years, away at certain times. That's the case even today for many in the military, and yet, as much of a a strain as that is for families, in Solomon's day, there were no cell phones or email or postal service. Ability to communicate. The last group of workers I'll mention are housewives, those who would have to place a bucket on their head or over their shoulders to go get water if they wanted some, because they couldn't just turn on the faucet and then make it adjust to the temperature they wanted. That was not an option for them. Preparing meals from scratch, no drive-throughs to pick up dinner, no stores to buy a meal in a box. They cleaned without Swiffers, which I suppose wouldn't matter as much if the floor was dirt. But if they had some kind of hard floor, Swiffers are nice. All their laundry by hand, no access to antibiotics or painkillers. A wife may have had little to no communication with her husband, depending on his job, not just when he got home, but all the time he wasn't at home working at his job. Was it possible for a wife to have joy in her toil? Was it possible for these sorts of men working to have joy in their toil? Yes, because it doesn't depend on what kind of job you have, according to Solomon. Solomon mentions no such restrictions. Whether with the boss or the worker bee, there is nothing better than to find enjoyment wherever we are, whatever we're doing. For the sake of full disclosure, we should probably tack on the fact that most of these families would have lived in a one-room house, if not actually a tent, which I like to think of as no escape. Because even in a big house, if you've got enough people, there's no escape. So you hear them roll over in the middle of the night. You hear them be sick. There's no quiet place for dad to go and put his feet up and watch television. There's no quiet place for mom. Everybody's snoring. Everyone's sleep talking. Everyone's wrestling was audible to everyone. While also having worship obligations, there's no doubt about the required sacrifices. Literally, the conferences that the men were required to attend in Jerusalem 3 times a year for certain feasts. There is no way that it was convenient when someone sinned or hit a certain time of uncleanness to get your 5, 7 kids all clothed and head down to the temple to stand in line to buy your animal to make the sacrifice so that you could not be unclean any longer. There is no way that's convenient. They didn't have 5-day-a-week work weeks or 8-hour-a-day jobs. Besides, from the beginning, God had established a 6-day work week anyway, and they didn't get 2 days then for the weekend. And what were they required to do on their day off? Well, they were required to not work, but they were required to worship. There was not a lot of sleeping in and laying around. These are people, point is, who knew the daily grind. When they read about the superlative prospect of joy and toil, nothing better than eating and drinking, finding joy in your toil, in your work, I suspect they would think we have a lot of advantages. We might complain about the complexity and busyness of life and say, well, it was a much simpler time. It would have been easier for them to do it. But they would probably tell us we're idiots for thinking that. Enjoyment in toil is not from having things exactly as we wish they could be. It's finding enjoyment in what we're doing. A third principle is that joy doesn't depend on successful or finished toil. Solomon says nothing about finding enjoyment when the project is completed. When the paper is turned in. When the house is all picked up. When the big push at work, when tax season is over. whatever it might be. It's not about the grade, the promotion, or the new client. Solomon finished multiple major projects, projects that, as I said a little bit ago, took years to complete in some cases, yet he concluded that those were vanity in and of themselves. I think about it in terms of my job as a pastor. I don't get to say I am done with my part until every sheep that I am around is complete in Christ. Which means if I'm going to be fussy until my job is done, then I'm going to have a lot of reason to be fussy for my time remaining on the planet. Because it's not going to be done. It is one of the reasons I like mowing, because it's pretty clear when you've got a swath over every spot in the yard. Whew, done. Lots of our jobs are not like that. Solomon is saying joy doesn't depend on successful or finished toil. Work is never ending. God made it that way, but he also gives the gift of joy in it. A fourth principle is that joy doesn't depend on the size of the paycheck you get for your work. None of us are going to have greater income than Solomon. We're not going to have more resources than he did. He had more money than he could possibly have used. Yet, according to Solomon, money in and of itself was vanity. It was empty. If the one with the most money didn't get joy from his money, why do we expect to get joy in the next raise? Oh, if I could just have a job that paid me X. You want to get paid in more than letters, but as an algebraic fill-in, if I just had a job that could pay me such and such amount of money, then I could really relax and be happy. Not according to Solomon. And then, a fifth observation, joy doesn't depend on recognition for toil. The attaboy, the pat on the back. Work is not about self-esteem. Satisfaction doesn't come from a pat on the back. Solomon had enough money, he could have paid professional backpatters. Good job, buddy. Solomon is number one. Solomon's building projects are number one. He could have had people paid to tell him that. But the joy in this passage doesn't depend on recognition for what we've done. Whether someone values our contribution or not doesn't matter if the joy is God-given. If Solomon's readers could enjoy their toil, so can we. We do an awful lot of complaining. We rationalize our lack of joy because we're busy or because we don't like what we're doing. We do not have a harder life than they did. It is almost as if we think our toil should not be toil, which any dictionary will tell you. There is a difference between the word toil and recess, or between the word toil and vacation, or between the word toil and break. It's toil, it's work, it's labor for a reason. Work is hard, that's why we call it work. And Solomon says there's nothing better than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Now, I've called that the superlative prospect, meaning it's the superlative possibility, not a guarantee. Joy is not guaranteed in our toil, but the rest of verse 24 through verse 26 tell us who joy comes from. And that's important. So the next major point in the second part of verse 24 through verse 25 is the sovereign source of joy and toil. Superlative prospect, sovereign source of joy and toil. Because joy is no guarantee. Joy is a gift. And it's a gift from God. God is the giver. The preacher explains that enjoyment of one's work, enjoying the process, is from the hand of God. When I say, I had my hand in something, or I had my hand in that project, I am meaning to say that I was personally involved. So joy in the process, we'll read here, is from the hand of God, from His direct personal involvement in human affairs. In the case of joy in toil, God's hand is the only hand that ultimately matters. Look at the second part of verse 24. This also I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from Him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? God is in control of who gets joy, which means He gives to one and withholds from another. Just because I work or I work hard doesn't guarantee anything. The fruit of my labor is not always enjoyment. Some of you will remember this very helpful, I think, quote from Doug Wilson. He described it this way, quote, God is the one who gives things, and God is the one who gives the power to enjoy things. These are distinct gifts, just as a can of peaches and a can opener are distinct gifts. Only the first is given to the unbeliever. The believer is given both, which is simply another way of saying that he has given us the capacity for enjoyment. Just to get the can of peaches might actually make it more frustrating. We need God to give both the work and the joy in the work. Verse 25 makes it clear, for apart from Him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? It's a rhetorical question reminding us of what we instinctively know, that God is in control, so joy depends on Him as well. Everything depends on Him, including the joy. Which means that by itself, better personal time management does not guarantee gladness. Once you've got your task list dialed in, baby, probably be prepared for it to be ruined by some providence. Working harder does not automatically make us happier. Working smarter is not the promised source of joy. God is the source of joy. I've got a personal example of that. Something that I can only give God credit for giving me joy in, which is my treadmill. My wife got me a treadmill 10 years ago to the week. I've been a treadmill runner now for a solid decade, and I use it all the time. As if you've talked to me about it, you know that I am always saying I would much rather go for a run on my treadmill than run outside on the most beautiful Pacific Northwest day you could possibly imagine, which for me would include wind and rain and a little bit of cold temperatures anyway. Mo and I were driving in the car the other day. We were talking about Hawaii. I would love to go back to Hawaii someday, like I did, went with the Weinbergs, I don't remember what year it was. And I loved looking at the ocean from the treadmill out the window. When I want to know what the weather is doing, I lift up my garage door. I enjoy running on the treadmill. Many people don't like running to begin with. Most who do like running detest treadmill running. Treadmills are typically used as an illustration of meaningless monotony, if not actually an illustration of hell on earth. So I can only explain that I get joy out of it because God has given me that gift. Some weeks I'm on the treadmill for 5 to 7 hours. I like it because God lets me like it. Even if I died tomorrow, I would still have enjoyed my time on the treadmill because it isn't about making sure I live a really long, healthy life. Yes, that's good for me. It helps me. But it's not because I need to live long. I enjoy it. It is part of hopefully non-stressed out pursuit of better health than less health. But I give that as an example that we can either enjoy the process or we're striving after wind. even if not actually moving after it because we're on the treadmill. God does not promise that widget making is going to be easier or more prosperous, but He may give us enjoyment in it. The gift of God does not eliminate the chaos and the packed calendar. It does not wipe out late nights and early mornings. It doesn't remove exhaustion and treadmill running, but God's gift is to enjoy our work amidst the vanity from His hand. Which leads to the third and final main point, the simple qualification for joy in toil. The superlative prospect, the sovereign source, the simple qualification. Joy is not given to everyone. There are two types of people, those who obtain joy and those who don't. Verse 26 explains God's system. The joy receivers are the first part of verse 26. For to the one who pleases Him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. There it is. Joy. God-given wisdom and knowledge are good, but wisdom and knowledge have not gotten Solomon's head out of the water in Ecclesiastes so far. Joy is the difference maker. Joy is the thing we want with wisdom and knowledge. Joy is gladness and festivity of heart. Joy comes at the end of the list of wisdom and knowledge and joy because it's the turning point. So the critical question is, who are the ones pleasing God? For to the one who pleases Him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. How does someone please God? How do we get into this category of being the joy receivers? It's great to know that there's the prospect of joy. It's great to know that God is the source who gives the joy. But He gives it only to a particular group of people. How can we get into that group? How can we know that we're in position to receive it? Now, the preacher doesn't actually provide a lot of clues, at least right here in this paragraph or this verse by itself. But I anticipate that Solomon knew his readers would recognize the God-pleasing joy receivers from this paragraph. Namely, the ones who please Him are the ones who recognize that everything comes from Him. The ones who please Him are the ones who fear Him. Solomon is the writer of most of the Proverbs as well. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And by the end of Ecclesiastes, he says, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments. So fearing God is another way of saying we are considering who He is, that unless He is involved, unless He controls, unless He gives, it's not good. The ones who please Him are the ones who look to Him. The ones who please Him are the ones who get that everything under the sun is managed under Him and through Him and for Him. The ones who please Him are those who submit to His sovereignty rather than trying to be sovereign themselves. And so that's how it works out on a daily basis when we get into certain situations where we find ourselves not being joyful. What have we missed at that moment? We have missed who put us in the moment. Man, I hate that. Right? Because I have got how the day is supposed to go. And I've got my sacrifices scheduled in for everybody so that we're covered and then we're done with those. Like, I add extra in. Okay, I was going to do 10, but I've done 15. Now it's me time to get my stuff done. I am still at that point not fearing God in the sense of trusting Him and how He's arranging it moment by moment. It isn't just a think about your task list once in the morning for 5 minutes and then you're prepared. The ones who please God are the ones who are constantly trusting, submitting, and fearing Him. The biggest reason most of us don't have joy, and perhaps why Solomon doesn't talk about joy until this paragraph is that we're trying to do something futile. We're trying to be in control and then trying to make ourselves look awesome. Neither of those work. Not in control and not awesome. So no wonder there's no joy in such a futile attempt. On the other hand, no matter what we do or how many hours we spend shoveling gravel from one pile to another or how many miles we run on the treadmill, if our goal is to submit to Him and make much of Him, then what would stop you from doing that? If the goal is to get your project done, good luck. Work hard, make your plans, pray for God's blessing, but there's no promise there. If your goal is to show that God is great, well then what can't you do that's lawful, meaning not sinful? What is it you can't do to please God? As fantastic in terms of breaking down that dualism as well. That separation between sacred and secular. There isn't anything eating and drinking. If you can eat and drink and glorify God, if you can eat and drink and find enjoyment in your toil, then if that's the goal, then we'll be pleasing God, and those are the people who get joy. It's not actually that complex. That's why it's a simple qualification. All you got to do is just constantly trust God. And submit to Him. And seek His honor. And that whatever you're doing, whether people recognize it or not, whether it's hard or not, whether you get paid for it or not, can be with a lot of joy. The judgment receivers are the last group mentioned, the second part of verse 26. But to the sinner, He has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Giving up what you've worked hard to earn and gather is a miserable business. To the sinner, to the one who does not have God at the center of life, who isn't living for God, who isn't concerned with God, to that person, God has given something. God has given them the task. God has given them labor that they ultimately don't get to keep. It's not that He's given joy to one and He just leaves the rest alone. It's that God gives joy to some and gives others something worse. It's part of His judgment. It is vanity and frustration from the perspective of the sinner, someone who's not pleasing God. The person who says, "But that's not fair," is the person who is not fearing God. And no wonder then they think that it's not fair. This is the person who wants to be sovereign himself rather than trust the sovereign God. Again, from his perspective, vanity and striving after wind. The life of accumulation and acquisition is painfully empty for the sinner. God doing what He pleases is the worst news that the sinner could hear. So enjoy the process. Whatever the process is, whatever stage in the process you are, whatever your process looks like, as we know that joy is possible not based on a million things. Joy does not depend on a million things. It depends on God who gives it, and He gives it to those who love Him, who fear Him, who submit to Him. So, lack of joy is not a vocational problem, it's a theological one. Lack of joy. This does not mean that you can't get a different job. It doesn't mean you can't take advantage of opportunities that are around you. It means that you cannot place the blame for your lack of joy on the occupation or the toil itself. That blame goes to our theology, our understanding of God. Lack of joy is not an issue of paycheck, but of perspective. Joy doesn't depend on us. It comes when we depend on the hand of God. So what are you looking for or trusting in to bring you joy? What is keeping you from enjoying the process? It doesn't need to be anything other than a rearrangement of heart and perspective and trust and fear, worship. So there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Lord, help us to fear you, to relate to you, to trust you well and often, if not always. We depend on you, and sometimes we are more conscious of that, and we need to be conscious of it all the time, and trusting your hand is at work, that you're here, and you're there, and you are where we are as we're going there and doing the work. Your hand is involved, and from your hand comes joy, comes the ability not just to have the peaches, but to enjoy them, to do the work, but to enjoy it, to maybe succeed, maybe get paid, maybe not, but to trust you in the process and enjoy the process. So clear away the excuses maybe that we have. Remove the things in our own hearts that we blame for our lack of enjoyment in the process. And make us a people who ETP as we trust and fear you for wisdom and knowledge and joy. We pray in your Son's name. Amen.